Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, murder, violence, sexual assault, rape, child abuse, and racism.
The campaign in Paraguay has entered its second year and led the Argentine Republic into the deepest tragedy. We find ourselves bloodied and exhausted of resources, of gold and credit. Such is the campaign against the Russia of South America, defended by its marshes and sloughs, its diseases and deep forests, and by inhabitants who never surrender, save at the tip of a sword. Thus far, the engagements have all been massacres without result, save to pile up thousands of killed and wounded, without our advancing a step forward nor breaking the will of an enemy disposed to defend his soil, man by man, inch by inch. It has become a war of extermination, and if things continue, within 5 months, the Argentine army will be decimated by disease and the shot of the Paraguayans. Even if we win, we will see our flag shredded into a skeleton. El Nacional, Buenos Aires, June 22nd, 1866. As the fighting subsided, a ghastly sight met the men in the Allied trenches. A full 7,000 Paraguayans and Allied soldiers lay dead before them on a field which was barely a mile long. Their bodies were bunched up in unnatural ways, the pain of their death still upon many of the soldiers' faces. Others were found face down. A small nick in the cheek was the only sign of physical damage. When the bodies were turned over, it was apparent that their faces had been blown away, the work of the newly designed French mini-ball. Hundreds of other bodies bobbed up and down in the surrounding esteros and lagoons. It was absolutely crucial for Allied corpse disposal units to get to work quickly. In a matter of days, bodies would become so rotted from the humidity that they would often rupture and come apart at the joints. To make matters worse, there was no way to bury the dead due to the muddy landscape. The bodies had to be burned. Huge piles of corpses were placed in pyramid-like structures and then set alight. The Paraguayans had already been suffering from malnutrition before they perished. Their bodies refused to burn due to the lack of fatty tissue on their corpses. Onlookers described how these corpses, quote-unquote, mummified in the flames. The only way to burn these bodies was with oil. The fumes that emanated from the rotting, charred human flesh pervaded the battlefield for weeks afterward. Unused cartridges, which were still on the soldiers' corpses, would explode in the flames, sending the charred body parts in all directions. Scarcely 2 years previously, such devastation could never have been imagined for the people living in Paraguay, Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, then called the Banda Oriental. In fact, the conflict, which is remembered as the War of the Triple Alliance, or the Paraguayan War, began over politics and boundary disputes over borders, which had existed since these nations gained their respective independence. This war defined the future for each country involved. Paraguay has always been isolated, and as a result, Paraguay is distinct from its South American neighbors. It has no coastline of which to speak, but possessed many rivers and byways which flow through the country. Because of the presence of these rivers, there are many esteros and lagoons, and due to this fact, roads were not developed in a meaningful way until much later. Riverine movement was the most common mode of transportation. One of Paraguay's main exports, then and now, is yerba mate. This is a locally grown herb which is mashed and then combined with hot water. It is a highly caffeinated beverage, but it does not cause anxiety and teeth staining like coffee does. Finally, Paraguay has one of the largest indigenous populations in all of the Americas, and Guarani, the native language, is still considered the official language besides Spanish, with approximately 90% of the population speaking it today. Paraguay's early colonial history was defined by the Jesuits, who were largely successful in converting the native population. Additionally, the Jesuits petitioned the Spaniards to introduce African peoples, who had been trafficked in the slave trade, to the country in order to quote-unquote replace the native population, who were dying in droves. As we have discussed, Spanish treatment of native populations was abhorrent. This is especially true in neighboring Bolivia, where millions of natives died in the Spanish mines located in Potosi. Paraguay was largely bereft of mining resources as well as geographically isolated, so the natives were allowed to thrive, and they formed the backbone of the Paraguayan state, while the original Spanish colonizers made up the state bureaucracy and the quote-unquote nobility. Enslaved Africans were also trafficked into Paraguay, but in much smaller numbers compared to Brazil. In the 18th century, Spaniards formally asked the Jesuits to leave Paraguay. In their wake, they left a partially literate population who would go on to fuse their native culture and language with the religious precepts of Catholicism. When Buenos Aires declared the independence of the soon-to-be Argentine state, Paraguay was originally connected to it. This would not last. Under a triumvirate headed by José Gaspar Rodríguez de Francia, Paraguay broke away from Buenos Aires and became an independent country. The other two triumvirs died, likely being killed by Francia. Francia then called a congress in which he had himself named dictator, first for 2 years and then for life. His rule was defined by espionage, espionage, and a little more espionage. People and their opinions were tracked by an intensive domestic spy service, which outed and condemned any who were found speaking out against Francia's iron rule. He shut Paraguay down. No trade, immigration, or communications were allowed to leave or enter the country. Anyone found in violation of these laws was detained, tortured, and then shot. Francia was deeply concerned with possible assassination, so much so that George Thompson says, quote, "When he rode in the street, everyone was obliged to hide, even women, for his escort used to beat everyone found in the street when his excellency passed," unquote. Francia died in 1840 at the age of 85, and two quote-unquote consuls were chosen to replace him. One of them was General Carlos Antonio López, or López I, who soon seized supreme power, much like his predecessor. He reversed many of the draconian economic policies Francia had put in place. He opened up the country to outside trade, and the economy grew as a result. Yerba mate proved to be an invaluable export. López I then began to fill the government and military with either yes-men or direct family members. This included his first son, Francisco Solano López, or López II, who was named the general-in-chief of the army. López I may have reformed the economy, but the internal affairs of Paraguay remained largely unchanged. Regardless, Paraguay modernized in many respects, building their own railroad and installing extensive telegraph cables to connect isolated provinces. Although Lopez I was very similar to Francia in terms of his draconian policies, he did manage to pass a bill which outlawed slavery throughout the country, although it only applied to newborns and those who were already enslaved were not freed. In the early 1860s, Paraguay led an army into Corrientes, which was located just over the border in Argentina. On the whole, Paraguay was uncontested. Native Guaycaru raids were the only serious, quote-unquote, disturbance, but these were put down with extreme violence. In Corrientes, the army saw no action, and the invasion came to nothing, with both sides trusting in diplomacy. Although the invasion came to nothing, it complicated the geopolitical situation in South America. The Rio de la Plata, which resides partially in Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil, would soon become highly contested. Besides their intrigue and machinations along this river, territorial disputes already existed between Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia. Paraguay and Brazil were each attempting to claim the area of Mato Grosso in south-central Brazil. Both sides claimed large tracts of the province, while each refused to recognize the other's claims. Argentina was focused on expanding into Patagonia and displacing the indigenous people there. They had only delved into South American foreign policy once, when they supported the destruction of the Peru-Bolivian Confederation in 1836. Although they called themselves a liberal democracy, Argentina was better categorized as a sort of factional confederation of vying ideologies who all supported a different version of the Argentine future. In Buenos Aires, many porteños believed Argentina's future was in their hands. They believed the way forward lay with a strong central government coupled with liberal economic policies like free trade. On the other hand, Confederationists supported a more loosely structured Argentina in which regional power would trump any central authority. As the 1860s began, Argentina was in a state of civil war. The several vying factions, including the Porteños and the Confederalists, would decide the fate of the Argentine nation on the field of battle. The outcome resulted in a Porteño victory, after which Bartolomé Mitre became the new president. He was considered an outstanding politician and a visionary leader during his time, but the conflict on the horizon would sully his image forever. To the north and east of Paraguay lay the Empire of Brazil. For many decades, the empire was under the sole leadership of Pedro II. He attempted to exert Brazilian dominance throughout the South American continent in a number of onerous ways, especially from the point of view of the people who surrounded and composed the Brazilian nation. Brazil practiced chattel enslavement until 1888. They had also sufficiently entrenched themselves in Uruguayan politics, and they were responsible for crushing several rebellions and secession movements in the 19th century. The most famous example is the Ragamuffin War, during which Giuseppe Garibaldi met his wife Anita and learned from the fast-moving gaucho warriors of the Pampas. Finally, the country of Uruguay, or the Banda Oriental, has a history which is fraught with violence, turmoil, and massacres. For decades, Argentina and Brazil argued over who would lay claim to the territory. Over the course of several wars, the Banda Oriental found itself in the middle of a revolution headed by Venancio Flores, a lifelong gaucho fighter. Utilizing the assistance of Brazil, both monetarily and militarily, Flores managed to usurp his enemies and become the new president. He had the Coloradans on the run in a major way and was gaining allies throughout the country while decimating it. Back in Paraguay on September 10, 1862, Lopez I had finally succumbed to an illness which he had battled for a long time. In the wake of his death, his first son, Lopez II, seized the capital and rapidly assumed dictatorial control of the functions of state. Lopez II followed Francia and Lopez I's lead in a serious way and punished any who decried these past rulers. George Thompson concludes Lopez II did this because his, quote, own system would have been next to come under criticism, unquote. Lopez II learned from these past examples and from his former professors of military science in Europe. There was always tension between Paraguay and Brazil, and Lopez II did nothing to combat this. The situation in Uruguay ramped these tensions up significantly. Lopez saw Brazilian assistance of Flores as a veiled attempt by the Brazilian Empire to expand their hegemonic power in the region. He claimed any further interference by Brazil in Uruguay would disrupt the quote-unquote balance of power. And if it continued, Paraguay would be forced to quote-unquote defend itself. Starting in 1864, Lopez began to prepare his country for war against Brazil. This was justified as an attempt to assist the Coloradans in Uruguay. As many as 80,000 Paraguayans were mobilized, drafted into the army, and sent to various key locations throughout the country. Support for the war was artificially drummed up across Paraguay. The capital of Asunción was home to numerous manufactured celebrations and protests in support of the war. These falsified events continued unabated for as long as Asunción remained in Paraguayan hands. Lopez answered these protests and celebrations with these words, quote, Paraguay must no longer consent to be lost sight of. When the neighboring states are agitating questions which have more or less a direct influence against her dearest rights, I have called the attention of the Emperor of Brazil to his policy in the River Plate. I yet hope that my voice will be heard. But if it should not be so, and my hopes should turn out in vain, I shall call on you, feeling certain that the patriotic decision with which you are animated will not fail me for the triumphing of the national cause. Unquote. On November 10, 1864, the Marquis de Olinda traveled from Montevideo, Uruguay, to Corumba, Brazil. It carried the new president of Mato Grosso upon it. Lopez was aware of this steamer, and he pondered for a whole day whether he should break the peace. He said, quote, If we don't have war now with Brazil, we shall have one at a less convenient time for ourselves, unquote. It was then decided to seize the Brazilian steamer and imprison all those on board. This act of piracy occurred without a declaration of war. Those on board were treated horrifically by their Paraguayan captors, and most of them died during their imprisonment due to the heinous conditions in which they were kept. The president of Mato Grosso lived for years under guard until he was shot, alongside six others, at Pasapuco in 1867. Lopez tried to frame the seizure of the Marquez as a defensive act, but when word reached the rest of the world, he received universal denunciations, especially from the press in Argentina. They mercilessly attacked Lopez, and this deeply affected him. He even sent official diplomatic communiques to Argentina in the hopes of getting President Mitre to censor his press. Back in Uruguay, the two vying factions fought for control of the country. Brazil had joined the conflict on the side of Flores and the Blancos, and their combined forces pushed the Colorados off the field, where they entrenched around the town of Paysandú. Besides this small alcove of resistance, all of Uruguay was under Blanco and Brazilian control. Inside Paysandú, Brazilian forces entered the town unopposed under the guise of wanting a truce. They captured the Coloradan leader and began an indiscriminate massacre of the garrison and the town's population. Seemingly, no one could oppose Flores. Brazil could now focus on the Paraguayan invasion of Mato Grosso. Paraguay turned north towards Mato Grosso to settle several border disputes in the region. Lopez was truly concerned about the plight of his supposed allies in Uruguay, he would have sent all his men south. As it stood, 3,000 of his best soldiers were sent into a province about the size of Germany and told to capture and destroy as much as possible. Amongst these 3,000 were the 6th and 7th battalions, which consisted mainly of Afro-Paraguayans. They were called the Small Ears by their racist commanders. Their main objective was the city of Coimbra. It had a garrison of 400 men defending it and was well placed to receive any Paraguayan attack. On December 27, 1864, Paraguayan leadership formally demanded that the garrison surrender. After they failed to do so, the city was assaulted. Paraguayans tried and failed to storm the walls of the city, but Brazilian artillery drove them back. Over 200 men were killed or wounded. The next day, plans were drawn up for another assault, but the Brazilians fled the town in the dead of night. The inhabitants of Coimbra were now at the mercy of the Paraguayans. George Thompson says, quote, "The women were ill-treated, and Barrios, the Paraguayan commander, took the lead in it. A Brazilian gentleman and his daughter were taken to him on board his steamer, and on the old man refusing to leave his daughter with Barrios, he was sent away under threat of being shot, and his daughter kept on board." Unquote. Further atrocities were committed on the river when the soldiers upon Paraguayan steamers boarded several Brazilian ones. In many cases, the Brazilians panicked and jumped into the river, only to be shot in the backs by the Paraguayan soldiers. Those who surrendered were just as likely to be killed as well. Many Brazilians were decapitated, their heads returned to Lopez as quote-unquote trophies. This practice would spread to the Allied side and become commonplace as the war increased in intensity and violence. Meanwhile, the invasion of Mato Grosso stirred the Brazilian nation into solidarity like no imperial ordinance could. Tens of thousands of Brazilians from every corner of the country volunteered for the army. Brazil was acting like a unified nation for the first time in its entire history. But it would take time to get these men trained and equipped, as their armies were mainly tied up in Uruguay. At the start of 1865, Lopez was facing a conundrum. He wished to veer south with a large army and assist his Coloradan allies, who were being hunted down one by one. In order to do this, he would have to pass through neutral Argentine territory. There was only one problem. Argentina was refusing their requests and also sending covert aid to Flores. Lopez felt that this was the last indignity he could suffer from Argentina. He blamed the entire nation for the views of its major newspapers. He claimed that Argentina's leadership was frustrating his designs to quote-unquote assist his allies. Lopez invaded Argentina directly under the guise of this reasoning. His abrupt invasion of Argentina had its advantages, in the short term at least. Argentina had no national army, just a handful of militia brigades who were loyal to their caudillo, or regional leader. Like in Brazil, the Paraguayan invasion stimulated feelings of national togetherness across many parts of Argentina. In no time at all, they had an army of 24,000 in training and had authorized emergency war bonds. They also granted the rank of field marshal to President Mitre. Argentina was now inexorably drawn into the conflict. President Mitre met in secret with the Allied leaders, and terms were agreed upon. This is remembered as the Treaty of the Triple Alliance. Terms are briefly laid out thus by George Thompson. Quote, "The Allies bind themselves not to lay down their arms until they have abolished the government of Lopez, not to treat with him unless by common consent. The independence of Paraguay is guaranteed. Paraguay is to pay the expense of the war. The fortifications of Humaita are to be destroyed, and no others allowed to be built. No arms or elements of war are to be left to Paraguay." Unquote. Bartolomé Mitre was selected as the overall Allied commander, but the Brazilian Navy was given independence from his command. They were led by Joaquim Marques Lisboa, the Marques of Tamandaré. President Mitre promised that the Allies would be in Asunción in 3 months. The forces were now in position to begin the most devastating conflict in South American history. The Paraguayans had 80,000 men at this point. They were all dressed in bright red camisetas or blouses, and usually white pants. Save for the elite guard of Lopez, none of the soldiers wore shoes. The Brazilians wore a navy blue jacket, similar to those of the American Union soldiers, as well as gray jackets, which resembled the Confederate uniform. The Argentines wore a hodgepodge of different uniforms, with the colors usually denoting the region from which they came. Discipline in the Paraguayan military was strictly enforced, and rule breakers were severely punished. George Thompson said a sergeant, quote, was allowed to order a soldier to receive 12 blows with a stick, and an officer almost as many as he liked, unquote. Soldiers were expected to withstand these abuses and much more. They were even expected to refer to their officers as fathers, while officers referred to their soldiers as their children. On the other hand, the Allies were less pernicious toward their soldiers, at least at first. As the war dragged on and mutinies, rebellions, and desertion increased, more strident measures were employed to ensure that Allied troops, quote-unquote, did their duty. The campaign against Argentina began on April 14, 1865, with 3,000 Paraguayans storming over the border. That same day, vanguard cavalry entered Corrientes. The Correntinos spoke the same language as the Paraguayans, so their rights and lives were usually respected. The exiled Argentine government declared that any Correntinos found working with or for the Paraguayans would be shot upon the Argentine return to power. In Entre Rios, in northwestern Argentina, Justo José de Urquiza was the most powerful caudillo in the country. He controlled massive tracts of land used for cattle and horse rearing. It was hoped he'd be able to quickly dispatch Lopez, but his regional loyalties dissuaded him from moving his men. Additionally, he would not contribute anything to the war effort which wasn't purchased by the Argentine state at a nice markup. There were whispers that he was secretly on Lopez's side. This remains debatable. Paraguayan forces in Corrientes now swelled to over 6,000 men. By the end of May, they fielded 16,000. General Wenceslaus Robles, a Polish expat, had another army of 25,000 nearby. These forces departed from Corrientes, leaving a garrison of only 1,500 men. Brazilian naval vessels moved in the war for the first time and landed 2,000 men with 2 guns. The rest of the fleet and infantry on board pounded the Paraguayan position at Corrientes. They fell back to a stone bridge, where they made a determined stand. Bodies piled up on each side of the bridge until the fire was too great for the Paraguayans to withstand. Both sides suffered around 400 casualties, and Corrientes was back in Allied hands. As June began, Lopez made the decision to travel to the front, where he intended to stay the rest of the war. He did this to have a more direct hand in giving orders and strategizing. Having already lost the crucial city of Corrientes, the Paraguayan navy was ordered to clear the way on the River Paraná. Upon encountering Brazilian naval vessels, the Paraguayans kept steaming ahead, and only after gaining space did they attempt to turn around and engage the Brazilians. This poorly thought-out maneuver resulted in the Brazilians being totally prepared for the Paraguayans. To make matters worse, the Paraguayan navy had no grappling hooks with which to board the Brazilian vessels, meaning the Brazilians were able to pull away whenever the enemy got too close. In the end, the Battle of Riachuelo was the most decisive naval engagement in South American history. The Paraguayans were decisively defeated, their navy losing 10 separate vessels, while the Brazilians lost 1 cruiser. In total, 750 Paraguayan sailors were casualties, as opposed to 247 Brazilians. At this point, and for all intents and purposes, the campaign in Corrientes was lost, and plans should have been made for an immediate withdrawal from Argentina back into Paraguay. As it stood, Tens of thousands of Paraguayans were now cut off from supplies and forage for their horses. Robles was encamped near Empedrado, while another army under José María Borges shuffled south following the defeat on the Riachuelo. As this invasion fell apart, another Paraguayan invasion force of 12,000 attacked Uruguay, bound for Rio Grande do Sul in southern Brazil. This force became completely isolated from the rest of the army and had no means of communicating its position once it became lost. They stormed the city of Uruguayana and began to fortify it against Allied assaults. Just across the river, a smaller contingent of Paraguayans were sent to defend the town of Yatay. On August 17, 1865, Uruguayan President Flores moved on Yatay with a force of over 13,000 men. The two forces clashed violently, with the outnumbered Paraguayans refusing to surrender and choosing to fight to the death. The Allies lost 2,500 men killed and wounded, while the handful of Paraguayans who chose to surrender were drafted into the Uruguayan army. On August 25th, Mitre arrived with an even larger Argentinian army with the objective of capturing Uruguayana. They beseeched the Paraguayan commander to surrender. His response began, quote, "As your excellencies show so much zeal in giving the Paraguayan nation its liberty, according to your own expressions, why have you not begun by freeing the unhappy enslaved peoples of Brazil, who form the greater part of its population?" Unquote. Unsurprisingly, he went on to state that he refused to surrender. 30,000 allies were prepared to storm the defenses, which were manned by a skeleton force of beleaguered Paraguayans. The Paraguayans inside Uruguayana were beyond desperate, and 6,000 had already perished from disease and starvation inside the city. They had no hope remaining, and no communications from Lopez had arrived since June. The Paraguayan commander made the decision to surrender his forces to the Allies in exchange for reasonable treatment. This was granted, and the hobbled army of 6,000 Paraguayans surrendered their arms. Lopez immediately ordered the rest of the army in northern Argentina to fall back into Paraguay with haste. Their forces, under Robles, did a reasonable job extricating themselves. They even managed to bring more than 100,000 heads of cattle, but many of the cattle died as a result of a poisonous shrub, which Paraguayan cattle had already learned to avoid. Dead and rotting cattle marked the line of retreat for the Paraguayans, who had lost a third of their invading force. From this point on, the war became, in many respects, a massive siege of the country of Paraguay. Manpower in the country was already low, and many old men and teenagers were being drafted into the army in increasing numbers. These replaced many of the men lost during the first year of the war, but they could not replace the professionalism of those who had died. In the fallout of the mass retreat of Paraguayan forces, Lopez looked for scapegoats on whom he could pin the blame. General Robles was at the top of this list, and he was executed on the orders of Lopez. He promised more reprisals for any of his officers who failed to carry out his orders to the letter. The regrouped Paraguayans made a defensive bastion out of Paso de la Patria, constructing earthworks, trenches, and parapets, which were formidable against assault and impractical to flank. The Paraguayans fought for several reasons. Obviously, they were terrified of what the Lopista regime would do to them. Besides this, they fought because they had to. Their homes were being invaded, and Lopez claimed the Brazilians would enslave and rape every citizen if they were allowed to take the country. This fueled intense prejudice on all sides of the conflict. Paraguayans hated the Brazilians and mocked their fighting ability. They derisively called the soldiers fighting for Brazil quote-unquote monkeys and quote-unquote darkies. Paraguayan soldiers committed atrocities against the Allies, further fueling the atrocities committed by the Allies. For their part, the Allies were deeply racist towards the Paraguayans, especially those of native Guarani descent. They openly called them, quote-unquote, barbarians, and said they acted like Lopez's, quote-unquote, slaves. On the Allied side, the Brazilians were under the nominal command of General Manuel Luis Osorio, but the terms of the Triple Alliance Treaty stipulated that all Allied forces were under the overall command of Argentine President Mitre. However, the Argentine and Uruguayan armies were not prepared for war. Their soldiers were unaccustomed to organized forms of warfare. Thomas L. Wiggum describes their ways of war previous to this as a, quote, irregular gaucho style, unquote. The Brazilians were also unprepared for such a draining conflict, but they at least had experienced soldiers and a competent officer corps. Lopez was always frustrated when he was forced on the defensive. This was an unfortunate trait to possess, especially when he had been blessed with the naturally defensible terrain of Paraguay. He always called for action in the hopes of flustering the Allies. He sent small raiding parties across the Paraná River as 1866 began. These small attacks proved devastating to Allied morale, especially for those stationed in isolated areas. Paraguayans were told to, quote, capture some prisoners, unquote, but for the most part, they killed and decapitated any soldiers they captured. On January 30, 1866, the most violent of these raids occurred at Corrales. Even though they were outnumbered almost 8-1, the Paraguayans trounced the Argentines to their front and only retreated when confronted by reinforcements. Both sides lost several hundred men each, but Lopez considered the engagement a total success and proof of the ineptitude of his enemies. Next, Lopez targeted the so-called Army of the Vanguard, which was composed of Uruguayans as well as Paraguayans, conscripted into the army following their surrender in 1865. Unsurprisingly, these Paraguayan conscripts made poor Allied soldiers, and many attempted to flee, while several were shot for desertion. At the Battle of Itati, the Army of the Van was isolated and relatively cut off from Allied units, save for by the river. The Paraguayans decided to test the lackadaisical Brazilian Navy's grasp on the Paraná River. Paraguayans invaded Itati and landed several thousand soldiers on the Allied side. This force was led by Colonel José Rodríguez Díaz, a soon-to-be general, and perhaps the best officer on the Paraguayan side. The Allied commander, seeing the impending storm of Paraguayans approaching, retreated with all haste from his position. But the Paraguayans followed them, firing at their backs and taunting them by saying, quote, "Where are the heroes of Yutai?" unquote. The raid was an absolute success, and Diaz was lauded for his aggressiveness while the Brazilian Navy was censured for their lack of action. This whole time, Allied forces prepared for a crossing of the Paraná River and a rapid advance on Asunción. To do this, they had to capture Redención Island. They accomplished this with relatively little loss of life. Besides this, the Brazilian Navy had finally sprung into action. Their ironclads and armed steamers were relatively successful at combating the meager Paraguayan Navy, who employed quote-unquote chatas, which were towed rafts that carried cannon emplacements. On the night of April 15, 1866, over 10,000 Brazilians made up the first of three Allied landing waves. Their destination was Itapiru. General Osorio led the way at the front of his men, and coming upon over 2,000 dug-in Paraguayans, he ordered his soldiers to fix bayonets and charge. In a bloody melee, the overwhelming numbers of Brazilians won out, and they inflicted over 500 casualties on the Paraguayans at the cost of 300 Brazilians. The Allies were helped along by the weather, as it was raining heavily. This hampered any concerted Paraguayan counterattack. Lopez was many things, but he was also apparently a coward when under fire. He could boast about death and glory, but in reality, the moment he heard the whizzing of bullets, he ran from the carefully prepared positions at Paso de la Patria. In fact, Lopez left in such a hurry that he left behind his children and their mother. Without their dictator to direct them, the Paraguayans still present were hopelessly confused as to what they should do next. Only after some time did Lopez send orders for the garrison at Paso to retreat to the defenses at Estero Bellaco. The Estero Bellaco was a formidable natural position which consisted of two separate lagoons that would have to be crossed in order for the Allies to move forward. The Estero was a part of a larger defensive network remembered as Humaita. This dug-in position frustrated and annoyed Allied planners to no end. By the end of the war, Humaita gained a new nickname. It was now called the Sevastopol of South America, after the Ukrainian city, which resisted French, British, and Ottoman forces during the Crimean War. The Allies had crossed the river at a relatively light cost. They assumed that the war would be easygoing from here on out and that Paraguayan resources and manpower were already crumbling. They were in for a rude awakening as the Paraguayan people mobilized themselves in a way which has rarely been seen throughout the history of the world. The Allies were busy patching up relations with the major powers. They were facing international blowback when the full text of the Treaty of the Triple Alliance was read before the British Parliament. The British were unable to control the region directly, having been defeated or forced to retreat in two separate invasions of Argentina, so they decided to, quote, maintain the balance of power in the region, unquote. Their unveiling of the treaty was done to cover their own backs, as well as to drum up support for a quick end to the war. Lopez had about 35,000 men under his direct command. They were the few, quote-unquote, military-age men left in Paraguay. He also had about 100 separate artillery pieces, many of which were Congreve rockets. These projectiles had largely fallen out of favor throughout the rest of the world, but in the Paraguayan War, these rockets, developed by the British, would prove a crucial weapon for both forces and their artillery contingents. They were especially effective at close range, although their main flaw was errant accuracy. They had to be fired en masse because of this, but when they hit, the results were devastating. As it stood, Allied and Paraguayan units stood across from each other, separated by these two lagoons, exchanging fire often. President Flores of Uruguay was present with the Army of the Van. He was especially impatient to end the war and return to his country, where schemes and conspiracies were already afoot. Unfortunately for Flores, the Paraguayans attacked his position on May 2nd. Thomas Wiggum says, quote, "The Allied front was teeming with Paraguayans," unquote. They rapidly devastated and routed the units to their front and nearly captured Flores. On the extreme left of the Allied position, the Argentinians were faring just as poorly. Paraguayans had stormed their position and were going through the trenches, slaughtering any Argentinians they could find. The battlefield was chaos and butchery personified. Thomas Wiggum says, quote, "Two infantrymen, one Paraguayan and one Uruguayan, both with broken legs, berated each other with insults amidst the noise of battle. The two soldiers, thinking alike, crawled forward to within musket range and fired simultaneously. Both died on the spot," unquote. The Paraguayans might have achieved victory if they retreated then and there. Instead, they decided to push their advantage, but the Allies had regrouped and were already in the process of mounting a serious counterattack. The carnage endured for 4 hours, but the Paraguayans eventually succumbed to the overwhelming number of Allied forces. Allied units led by the Argentines stormed Paraguayan positions, and the Paraguayans had to retreat in haste, leaving many dead and wounded on the field. The losses were horrifying, especially considering the small battlefield. The Paraguayans lost over 2,300 men. The Allies lost at least 1,500 men. Regardless, the Battle of Estero Bellaco proved the Allied front was vulnerable to attack if they were not properly supplied and their communications were not adequately established. The Allies learned their lesson from this battle, but Lopez continued to believe that if he kept chipping away at them in repeated attacks, their morale would disintegrate and their leaders would sue for peace. The scenes after the battle were as terrible as the battle itself. One Brazilian describes, quote, an extensive rack of corpses piled in irregular mounds, with decapitated heads and eyes wide open. Some heads were split clean in half, the brain matter flowing out. Such was the enemy's path to death and glory, a glory drenched with tears, unquote. The Allies did rescue many of the wounded. They had access to modern medicine as well as small luxuries like soap. Regardless, amputations were always risky, but they were carried out in the hopes of stemming infection and saving the life of the amputee. In many cases, however, the operation resulted in shock and death for the afflicted. The Paraguayan side had it much, much worse. Thomas Wiggum says, quote, for every defect in the Allied medical services, the Paraguayans had three, unquote. There were few medical professionals in Paraguay, and even fewer at the actual front. Many stayed behind in Asunción, and if a wounded soldier ended up being ferried there, their odds of living improved dramatically. If, however, they were operated on in a field hospital, these odds dwindled severely. Amputations were done with machetes and sugarcane knives. Modern medicines were practically non-existent, so many Paraguayans turned to home remedies and native treatments to heal certain wounds and ailments. This included applying aloe vera to cuts and burns, and using local herbs as tonics for stomach ailments. Following the Battle of Estero Bellaco, the two sides settled into sniping matches and shouts of derision across no man's land for the rest of the month of May. On the 23rd, Lopez called his officers and men together and announced his plans to attack the Allied positions to his front with a huge force. He ordered 24,000 men to attack in three columns against the Allies. On May 24th, the sun rose and troop assignments were delivered. The men prepared themselves for battle as best they could. Thomas Wiggum says many drank, quote, a concoction of caña and gunpowder to steel their mettle, unquote. The columns of Paraguayans encroached on the Allied position as quietly as possible. And for a moment, it seemed surprise would be achieved. But a chance Brazilian scouting party witnessed their movements. The sergeant of this party told his commanding officer, quote, the forest had gone red with Paraguayans, unquote. This gave the Allies a few crucial minutes to get the word out before the signal for the Paraguayan attack, a red rocket, lit up the sky, and shouts of, let's go, reverberated throughout the forest. In a matter of moments, both sides were laying into each other with devastating musket volleys. On the Allied left, the Paraguayans flung back their Brazilian opponents, only to be met by determined resistance and counterattacks. They met these attacks with reckless abandon and, in turn, threw the Brazilians back on three separate occasions. The Brazilians were led into the fight by Osorio, who promised his men, quote, liquor and 3 months' pay, unquote. In the center, a sole battery, the Fosse de Mayette, prevented the collapse of the Allied line. Commanded by Emile Mayette, the hidden battery tore apart countless Paraguayans and was operated so efficiently by its gunners that it was nicknamed revolver artillery by Allied observers. Mayette said of the Paraguayans, quote, let them come. They won't pass through here, unquote. Mayette was proven right, and his battery held the line all day long. On the Allied right, Paraguayan cavalry was ripping into scattered Allied units. But they were soon confronted with determined resistance. Allied artillery was slowly but surely winning the day and whittling down the Paraguayans. The Paraguayan cavalry was destroyed, and not a man survived. All across the line, in fact, Paraguayans were falling back. By 4 p.m., the fighting had subsided, revealing the horror show which began this episode. The Paraguayans lost as many as 6,000 killed and another 7,000 wounded. The Allies lost as many as 4,000 killed and wounded. Lopez watched the development of the battle with what can only be described as pride. As thousands of wounded teenagers were transported back to camp, he turned to a Hungarian aide who accompanied him and said, quote, "Well, what do you think?" unquote. The aide responded, quote, "Sir, it is the greatest battle ever fought in South America," unquote. Lopez responded, quote, "I think the same as you," unquote. One of the immediate consequences of 2UT was the immediate conscription of most Paraguayan males. The only people not to be conscripted were foreigners and the trafficked peoples who were still enslaved. Besides this, every single boy or man able to hold a weapon was sent to the front. Only the quote-unquote justice of the peace and two old men were allowed to remain in the villages to maintain some semblance of order. Women were burdened with the majority of production from here on out, and they were forced to plow fields by hand since all the animals were taken as well. This fact obviously hindered mass production, and malnutrition and starvation became serious problems. The Allies did not follow up on the attack they endured at 2UT and instead hunkered down to resupply and reinforce. All throughout this conflict, disease and medical issues pervaded both sides, and both sides suffered because of it. Malaria, dysentery, measles, and smallpox were all prevalent. They ranged in severity and were often exacerbated by poor hygiene. It took months for these conditions to be quelled on the Allied side, but the Paraguayans had no such luck, and diseases of all varieties gnawed at the already weakened Paraguayans with reckless abandon. The next round of dreadful fighting would begin in early July and would culminate in an end-of-the-year massacre. At Yataytikora, both sides claimed victory in a two-day-long slaughter in which as many as 700 men died. 2 days later, Lopez ordered George Thompson and a contingent of men to build a forward trench, which would flank any Allied advance against the Estero. The Paraguayans worked with an intense energy all throughout the night. Come the morning, the trench line was nearly complete. Allied units were furious at this new obstacle, which would have to be surmounted if they were to advance on the main Paraguayan defenses. The Brazilian General Osorio was the most upset of them all. His own medical complications had made the task of ordering tens of thousands of soldiers onerous. In fact, his command was in the process of being transferred to General Polidoro de Fonseca Quintanilla Jordão. He was an able administrator, but was never loved at the same level as Osorio, who was still in charge of a division of Brazilians. On July 15th, the new Brazilian commander okayed an attack on the newly constructed Paraguayan trenches. Brazilians stormed these trenches relatively easily, as many Paraguayans were only armed with shovels. However, Paraguayan reserves stormed into the area in their thousands and battled the Brazilians for 6 hours. The Allies were being blasted by Paraguayan artillery, who were stationed on a nearby hill, and the decision was made to storm this position. This attack failed, and as night descended, both sides had suffered in excess of 1,500 casualties each. The next day, Uruguayan President Flores ordered his Army of the Van to assault the Paraguayan positions. In the face of massed rocket and small arms fire, the Uruguayans and their allies stormed the trenches. Flores was not satisfied with this small victory and wished to expand the Allied position further still. To do so, he and his men would have to charge across an open field known as the Bocaron. Without artillery support, the Allies pushed forward across this open field. Leading the way were many newly formed Argentinian units. They faced murderous fire up to the final Paraguayan trench, but many of their foreign officers inspired them to push on. They finally succeeded in capturing the trench, but that is when the trap was sprung. Paraguayan sharpshooters on either side of the Allies began what Thomas Wigham described as a, quote, "blizzard of musketry," unquote. The Allies were trapped. The only escape route was a blind run back the way they had come. In a matter of minutes, the Allied units in the trenches were utterly shattered and thousands lay dead and dying. Those who survived managed a mad dash back to their positions. This was not enough evidence for Flores, who demanded the trench be retaken. The Brazilian 6th Division went forward and was likewise ripped apart, its commanding officer dying in the maelstrom. Juan Cristomo Centurion said this battle resembled, quote, a vortex that swallowed masses of human flesh like an insatiable monster, unquote. In total, the Battle of Saus, or the Battle of the Bocaron, cost the Allies over 5,000 casualties. The Paraguayans had lost just over 2,500. It was the first clear-cut Paraguayan victory of the war. In spite of this victory, the Paraguayan army was in no position to push its advantage. They were always undersupplied and lacking soldiers. They increasingly turned to innovative tactics and weaponry to overcome their foes. One example of this was on the rivers. William Kruger, a U.S. citizen, was at the forefront of designing river mines which he believed would turn the tide of the war in Paraguay's favor. He sent out dozens of mines before being killed by one which prematurely exploded. His work was continued by his apprentice, a Polish man named Ludwik Majzkowski. None of these mines were very effective, save for one, which sank its intended target and killed or drowned dozens of Brazilian sailors on board. During a council of war held by the Allies, they decided to attempt to bypass the defenses at Estero Bellaco Norte and attack the Paraguayan positions at Curuzu. This plan was ambitious, but it was the only possible solution. This plan had one glaring weakness. Namely, the defenses at Curuzu were only the forward bastion to a much more defensible line at Curupaiti. This line ran perpendicular to a massive lagoon, making an assault upon it a virtual suicide mission. Regardless, before that attack could be launched, the position at Curuzu would have to be assailed. Brazilians were carried by boat in a massive flotilla and landed on August 1st. The ironclads of the Brazilian Navy steamed ahead and put the trenches of Curupaiti under bombardment. This was relatively ineffective and only served to supply the Paraguayans with extra shots for their guns. The Brazilian Navy wasted 4,000 shells and killed a single Paraguayan. On September 3rd, the land assault of the works at Curuzu began in earnest. It was as bloody and devastating as all the engagements thus far, but the Allies managed to invest and assault the trenches relatively quickly, capturing 13 Paraguayan guns. In total, 1,000 Brazilians died as opposed to 700 Paraguayans. Overall, it was a major victory for the Allies, who needed only to push through Curupaiti in order to flank Humaita. Thousands of Paraguayans streamed into Curupaiti and began a ferocious entrenchment of the area. For several crucial days, the Allies contemplated whether to attack the Paraguayans or not. On September 10th, the Allies were further obliged to hold off on their attack when a Paraguayan squad approached the Allied position under a flag of truce. Lopez said he wanted to discuss peace with the Allies, which would end the war and prevent any further bloodshed. For half an hour on September 11th, Lopez, Mitre, and Flores met for a short time. Lopez accused President Flores of starting the war through his conspiracies to destabilize the region. Flores responded that such an idea was absolutely ridiculous. Mitre attempted to be the cool-headed middleman in the exchange. He ensured Lopez the independence of Paraguay was a prime concern for the Allies, and that he and his family would be well provided for whilst in exile in Europe. Lopez reiterated his stance that he would not leave Paraguay unless it was in a coffin. This became the main sticking point for all parties involved. The terms of the Triple Alliance called for Lopez to be removed, but he could never allow such a thing to occur. The meeting ended abruptly, and both sides returned to their respective trench lines and prepared for what was to come. Behind the earthworks and parapets at Curupaiti, the Paraguayans had prepared a masterful defensive position. Their heavy guns were placed upon raised platforms for a clear view of the field, while 41 guns of smaller caliber supported the infantry at the front of the trenches. 5,000 Paraguayans awaited the assault of over 18,000 Allies. On the morning of September 22nd, The Allies left their camp in four separate columns, determined to storm the Paraguayan position. The soggy nature of the terrain meant Allied artillery could not support the attack. It was hoped that naval support would be enough to disrupt the Paraguayan defenses. But once again, naval fire failed to seriously hinder the Paraguayans. Following this intense but useless bombardment, the signal for assault was given to the infantry. Across an open, soggy morass less than a mile long, the Allies let off battle whoops, which were answered by the Paraguayans with their own sapucay, a Guarani war cry. The Allies carried scaling ladders with them, which were over 15 feet long, making them especially conspicuous. George Thompson retells the scene which played out next. Quote, "The Allies were thrown into disorder by the terrible artillery fire which crossed upon them from all sides," unquote. It was complete butchery for the Allies right from the beginning. To make matters worse, false reports were fed to Mitry which indicated much more substantial progress than what was actually occurring. As a result, the men were ordered to charge into certain death. Allied units were trapped under the Paraguayan defenses and had prototype grenades hurled at them from the Paraguayan trenches. Thomas Wiggum says, quote, "Every foot was marked with lines of the dismembered, the insensible, the slain," unquote. Candido Lopez was in the middle of this chaos. He would lose his right arm in the fighting. In time, he taught himself to paint with his left arm and produced stunning murals of the battle scenes he remembered after the war. The slaughter still raged pointlessly, with many Argentine units being sent up to reinforce their decimated battalions. Everything was pandemonium. When asked where his division was, a lieutenant responded, quote, "Here it is, sir. Four flags escorted by 60 men," unquote. The Paraguayans realized the hunt was on, and the men and boys in Curupaiti became overwhelmed with bloodlust. They stormed out of their defenses and unloaded their muskets into the retreating enemy. The Brazilians, assaulting on the left, fared no better and were equally torn apart by accurate and consistent Paraguayan artillery. They retreated in haste but were ordered to attack once more. High command still believed victory was near as their reports were still incorrect. Once more, the Allies marched over the bodies of their friends, comrades, and lovers. And once more, they were thrown back with horrendous losses. Many survived by playing dead or hiding themselves amongst the corpses of the dead. All throughout the fight, Paraguayan officers could be heard shouting, quote, "At last, they get what they deserve," unquote. In an afternoon, over 4,000 Argentines and Brazilians were butchered in front of the works at Curupaiti. Comparatively, the Paraguayans lost 54 killed and over 150 wounded. It was a devastating defeat for the Allies and one which could have been prevented if those in charge had the wherewithal to go to the front and see the battle for themselves, rather than trust in false reports. Allied medical facilities were soon overwhelmed, and fingers were pointed in all directions by the commanders of each country. The wounded close to the Paraguayan lines could not be extricated, and they were left at the mercy of the Paraguayans, who had precious little to offer. Two of those captured were Paraguayans who had been drafted into the Allied army. Jose Diaz ordered these men strung up as traitors, and one of them took a long time to die. He begged Diaz to finish him off, but Diaz said he deserved to die slowly like the traitor he was. The Allied dead were then further desecrated by the Paraguayans. Many bodies were chained together and dumped into the river, where they floated unceremoniously past Allied HQ. In the wake of Curupaiti, several momentous events occurred. First, President Flores packed his bags for Uruguay, where the political situation was beyond unstable. In Brazil, the eagerness that the citizenry had once exhibited toward going into battle had diminished substantially, especially in the far corners of the empire. Brazilian officials now resorted to mass conscription to replenish those lost at Curuzu and Curupaiti. The one man who still had a stomach for fighting was Emperor Pedro. he got both the liberals and the conservatives in his country to agree to placing Luis Alves de Lima y Silva, the Marquis of Cassier, in the position of commander of Brazilian forces. Cassier was perhaps the most well-known Brazilian military leader of the era. He had not participated in the war thus far because of political differences with those running the country. He was persuaded into accepting the role after his choice for prime minister came into power. His ascension to the head of Brazilian forces marked the beginning of Brazilian dominance amongst the three allied powers. From here on out, Brazilians made up the majority of those fighting and dying for the allied cause. Caxias arrived just in time. In Argentina's western provinces, rebellion was brewing amongst those disillusioned by the central state. Mitre would have to return to Buenos Aires and build an army to contest these rebels, or his rule would continue to be questioned or even usurped. These rebels were assisted largely by the government of Chile, who sent weapons and money to the rebels as well as, quote-unquote, volunteers. These rebels managed to capture a large swathe of western Argentina before authorities in Buenos Aires could seriously oppose them. Additionally, Argentines all across the country were very much against the war, and they began to see the Paraguayans as possible allies against a powerful Brazil, whom they always despised. Mitre left the Paraguayan front with thousands of Argentine soldiers. He was determined to crush the rebellion and then return to the war. This passed de facto leadership on to Casillas. The Paraguayans buckled down for the end of the year and rechristened the Curupaytí-Humaita line the Cuadrilatero, after a similar defensive position in Italy. There were few attempts at peace, save for those made by Charles Ames Washburn, the American ambassador to Paraguay. He was a terse and confrontational man who despised Lopez. He took pleasure in asserting his nation's quote-unquote greatness and refused to stand whenever Lopez entered the room. In short, he was everything that a diplomat should not have been, but he was granted his position due to his family name and President Lincoln's patronage. He was intensely interested in mediating peace between these belligerents, which he believed would enhance his own reputation. December 1866 was one of the hottest months in South American history. This, coupled with the humidity, led to suffering on both sides and further disregard for cleanliness standards. One change occurred in the Allied Navy. The ineffective Baron of Tamandaré was replaced by Joaquim José Ignacio. He promised to be more effective and active in bombarding enemy positions. Finally, on the Paraguayan side, the war effort was seriously hurt with the loss of General José Rodríguez Díaz. Little is known of his early life. And besides a brief stint as chief of police of Asunción, he had little experience as a leader of men. He was never a great strategist or a tactician, but he made up for this with an aggressiveness which won laurels from everyone, even the enemy. He followed Lopez and his orders to the letter, and Lopez returned his loyalty with admiration for his quote-unquote simpleness. Lopez especially loved Diaz for his bravery in the face of danger, something he rarely, if ever, showed himself. It was said that Diaz was, quote, more Paraguayan than the manioc root, unquote. On January 26th, he was scouting enemy naval positions when a Brazilian naval shell tore apart his boat. In the attack, the shell mangled Diaz's leg. Diaz was rushed to the hospital, where he was operated on and his leg amputated. For several days, Diaz hovered between life and death, and he was unable to keep his food down. Thomas Wiggum says, quote, on the morning of 7 February, he awoke feeling better than ever and spoke cheerfully to his nurses and associates. At noon, he took a bad turn. He announced his willingness to die, but loudly regretted that he would not live to see the final victory. He slipped away at 4:45 p.m. He was 34 years old. Unquote. If the start of 1867 was any indication, this war would not end with the death of a general, the loss of a single battle, or even the capture of a crucial city. The war continued unabated, as violence and dehumanization of the enemy increased on both sides. The Paraguayans were by no means defeated, and they showed that they could face any attack if prepared and entrenched. They also showed an impetuousness which was rarely seen in the 19th century, built around the cult of personality surrounding the quote-unquote Marshal Lopez. So long as he drew breath, Paraguay would remain at war. In the next episode, and final series-based episode of the year, we will cover the last 3 years of the Paraguayan War. Death, atrocities, massacres, and disease ravaged Paraguay, turning the country into one vast tomb. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. I hope you all have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.